Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, America. This is Just Talk Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, preparedness, and information. Judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman with Ethel Lopez. Cliff Stewart is on assignment. No, really, Cliff and Pastor Rose Banks, they're on another program tonight called Crime Beat. And so if you're one of those folks who like to multitask, we'd invite you to go out there and listen to them on Crime Beat on one ear and keep us on the other ear. And definitely at the 7 o'clock hour or at the top of the next hour, depending upon what time zone you're listening to us in. You can come back over to Just Cause Coast to Coast and listen to the entire rest of our program. But at least wanted to put that out there for you. Let me see here. Our dial-in number this evening is 347-205-9620. 347-205-9620. How are you this evening, Ms. Lopez?
I am awesome and ready to go.
All right. This evening, we're going to be talking about juvenile injustice. And, Ethel, we have found as we do shows and we have our exoneree moment, we had that discussion today and started thinking about the fact that a lot of our exonerees were juveniles when they got into the system.
Yeah.
And they were wrongly convicted when they were like 15 or 16 years old.
And 14
so
even.
Yeah. So we're going to be talking a lot about that. But let me get this disclaimer in here real quick. Ethel, Cliff, and I are not attorneys. And a Just Cause Coast to Coast does not provide legal advice. So please contact your personal legal advisor for your legal needs. Also, the opinions expressed by the callers or guests do not necessarily reflect that of a Just Cause or a Just Cause Coast to Coast. And as always, we want to thank you for tuning in this evening and choosing to spend this evening with us as we talk about judicial injustice. All right. So, Ethel. Let me see here. As far as shout-outs, I'll go ahead and do that. That's one of those things Cliff normally does. And we like to say thanks to, Scott Osborne and Duke Brooks from Contending for Truth. That's Scott Osborne. And then also from Conservative Nation Media, Duke Brooks and Michael Smith. Also Stephen Williams and a whole host of other folks out there who, are supporters of A Just Cause, are supporters of A Just Cause Coast to Coast, as well as the IRP6. Now, our guest this evening, Ethel, will include Mark Reiner. He is basically going to be a legal analyst on the call for us. And he's also the attorney for Curtis Shuler. And Curtis was a story that we did last week. And he was part of our exoneree moment. And he's wrongly convicted in Florida. But Mark is going to join us and talk about the overall subject of juvenile injustice. And go ahead.
No, I was going to say, Curtis was one of those who was also convicted at 16 years old.
As a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. And still fighting to get out.
Yeah.
And we have another story like that that's going to be coming up later on. His name is Mike Lubas, but Mike won't be able to be with us because he's still incarcerated. And his mother, Mary Ann Lubas, is going to be joining us. And then we also have Mr. Reddy from Right on Crime and rightoncrime.com. Actually, he's with the Texas. He's a policy analyst with the Texas Public Policy Foundation.
Yeah.
And so he'll be joining us here in just a few minutes. Just want to give a quick update on the IRP6. We always ask that you would keep our brothers in prayer. That's Gary Walker, David Banks, Demetrius Harper, Clinton Stewart, Kendrick Barnes, and David Zerpolo. They are doing very well, except for the fact that they are wrongly incarcerated. And we are continuing to fight on their behalf. There is a new press release out that we put out today, and that is featuring Andrew Alberelli. He was on the program on Tuesday evening, and Ethel, if you recall, he was talking about the staffing industry and how the guys should have never, ever been incarcerated.
That's right.
Because they didn't do anything wrong.
That's
so,
right.
At any rate, keep our brothers in prayer. And, send you can send cards and letters to A Just Cause or you can send emails to a Just Cause, and we will share that with the guys. Now, Ethel, one of the things that we're doing, you know, there's that situation with the 200 pages of missing transcript.
Exactly.
We have the attorneys, Mark Garagos, Tina Glandian, and Gwendolyn Solomon. They are working diligently on that situation. And but at the same time, we're reaching out to the Department of Justice and Attorney General Eric Holder to get something done on that. So, Ethel, what do we have going with that?
You know, we want him to tell us something. We've been reaching out to him for over a year, you know, to investigate the case of this missing transcript. Over 200 pages. You know, and it's now they're telling us, you know, that they can't get involved because it's under appeal and this kind of thing. Well, we're not talking about the appeal. We're talking about investigate where these over 200 pages of missing transcripts are.
Absolutely.
Because they cannot get a fair appeal decision without that transcript.
Absolutely. And that's one of those things that Mark Garagos is working on.
Yeah.
And then also we have a petition out on change.org where you can go out there and sign that petition. And after you sign it, we put this out to the listening audience all the time. After you sign that petition, you know, put in the comment section why you signed it. You know, why is it important for you that something is done in the case of the IRP6?
Yeah.
And then we're also asking folks that, you know, if you know of anyone or if you yourself, while you're listening, if you have a platform that can help to propel this story to a national level, we ask that you, you know, jump into the fight. Help
Absolutely.
Us out. And go ahead.
Yeah, and not only that, let me give you that number. Just in case you don't have Eric Holder's number, 202-514-2003 and 2005. And we're also asking people to reach out to their local radio and television stations and tell them you've heard about this case and you want to know why they are not reporting on it.
That's right. And you know, Ethel, I'll use the term, let's burn up his phone.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we don't want to.
Yes, that other word.
Don't want to
like
use that other word, yeah.
Okay.
We don't need anybody knocking at the door, you know. So burn up their phones.
Yeah,
you
burn
know.
Them up.
Let them know that we need you to do something and that this is just injustice. I mean, you know, when you look at some of the comments out there. Absolutely. You look at some of the comments out there on change.org and you see where people just say, you know, I signed the petition because it's just the right thing to do. And because this is wrong, this is just injustice that's going on.
Yeah.
Okay, so we want to invite you to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. You'll see a lot of activity out there. We also have a couple of websites, three websites, actually. If you'd like to follow us when we're talking about the IRP6 case, there's a lot of information out on freetheirp6.org, freetheirp6, that's the number 6.org. You can listen to archives of the of A Just Cause Coast to Coast at ajcradio.com, and that is an excellent website. And then
excellent.
We also, for our regular, for A Just Cause, we have a-justcause.com. Again, a-justcause.com. Okay, so Ethel, let's get to the news. As we stated earlier, our subject for the evening is juvenile injustice.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you have pulled a couple of articles that we're going to talk about here before we start pulling in some of our guests to take part in the conversation.
Absolutely. This one that I'm looking at, it's dated in November of last year, and it's by Arianna Huffington, Huffington Magazine This Week, titled Juvenile Injustice. And this gentleman, Chris Kirkham, he took an in-depth look into the private prison empire, and this was in Florida. And he looked at this Youth Services International prison system. For about 6 months, he went through pages of records. He went through lawsuits. He went through local police records and all kinds of stuff. And the man talked about he was just deeply disturbed as to what it was that he found. You know, he says that this organization, the Youth Services International, manages more than $100 million in contracts. And despite a record of abuse and mistreatment in the facilities, the company continued to win business in different states. You know, he says he don't know whether they're unwilling or unable to perform the oversight that's necessary, you know, for the juvenile justice there. Routinely, the awards contracts to a private prison operator without scrutinizing their records. They don't even take a look at these private companies that are trying to, you know, come in there. So all kinds of stuff happens.
And, you know, Ethel, I was looking at this as well, and it says that – you know, one former department executive, mm-hmm. you know, it's funny how people start, you know, talking after yeah. they leave an organization.
Exactly.
But anyway, one former department executive, he said that they don't want the providers to look bad because they don't have anyone else to provide this service. Bottom line is that the state of Florida doesn't want responsibility for these kids.
That's sad.
So it's like, okay, so you just turn the kids over and let whoever abuse them. I mean, it talks about them being abused, being served bloody food.
Exactly.
Being slammed headfirst into concrete walls.
Oh,
and, you know,
they
have lawsuits that are pending right now
choked
on some of this stuff.
Yeah, raw chicken.
And no one is, I mean, who's looking out for the kids?
But you know what? When I look at this thing and it talks about a former department executive, why couldn't he be a whistleblower? Why couldn't he talk about this stuff while he was there?
Absolutely.
Who cares about what you're talking about after you're gone?
Absolutely.
You know, your word is almost stank once you have left there and you have not stood up and done what was right.
Absolutely. And, you know, Ethel, I think we were looking at, and there are a lot of statistics out there on this. And when you look at the prison population, I mean, it is just out of control.
Yeah.
And when I look at the fact of at the national, like, I just pulled up Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Juveniles in custody in Florida, and I'm sure Mark would be able to shed even more specifics on this specific number when he joins the call later on. But juveniles in custody in Florida, in the state of Florida, 3,744. I mean,
wow.
that's outrageous.
Oh, my goodness.
And then at the national level, and I'll probably repeat these numbers a little bit later when we get deeper into this conversation, but at the national level, kids, and I say kids, 18 to 21, there are 2,700 folks incarcerated at the federal level. Those under 18 in the federal system, there are 33 of them. But still, I mean, it's terrible.
Yeah, it is.
What's this next article? You got one on from the Post and Courier.
Yeah, this one talks about, you know, grown-up injustice, life sentences for children. And they were talking about this Jody Kent Levy, I believe is her name. This came out in June of last year. And she's saying that a year ago, like in June of 2012, this is how the Supreme Court ruled in the Miller versus Alabama that it's unconstitutional to impose on a child a mandatory sentence of life without parole. And that is a huge step. That is awesome. You know, they talked about the courts, how they stopped short of striking down all life without parole sentences for children. And they require the judge to consider a child's maturity, their home environment, their role in the crime, and the potential for rehabilitation, and other factors that, you know, before they present these harsh penalties upon children. So that's a good thing that they've done there to take a look at that. And they are also talking about, you know, there's an investigation by the Center of Law and Global Justice found that the U.S. remains the only nation in the world.
That's terrible.
Known to sentence children to life without parole. A sentence to die in prison
as a kid.
Okay, but we have the best of everything, right? I mean, you know, we're America.
We have the best judicial system there is. Ha ha ha.
Okay.
It says that nearly 80% of youths sentenced to life without parole reported witnessing violence in their homes, according to the Sentencing Project. Now, more than half witnessed weekly violence in their neighborhoods. Most never received treatment for the trauma they experienced at youth age or at a young age. And so, you know, it's sort of the thing that you hear as far as, you know, being a product of your environment. And, you know, you're going to kind of do whatever you're exposed to.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you see something and the only way that you see it done, then that's the only way you're going to know to do it.
Absolutely.
And you're going to follow suit.
That's it.
And I think that's where Mr. Reddy, he's going to talk a little bit about that because he has some experience in doing studies on alternative programs as far as smart. Our phone number 47. Come back. Foundation.
government targeted. Prosecuted, convicted, six executives in, held back evidence.
Come on.
Hundreds of pages of Mr. Manuscript, court circuit, 10th district denying the writ of mandamus. Free the RP6, critical rights violations, scandalous. Their motivation to finish, they finish with major companies, the government, New York PD, DHS, potential customers.
Come on.
Faith attempt to obtain funding from banks and angel investors with no success. That calm mail down, finance skeptics, so they hire staff and come to fill the gap with every attention to fulfill the contract, fill the deal when money come back. Everybody paid the bills, the wages, take care of all of that. No Friday, they got viable software, but you prepare them to those with nothing to offer. Prosecuted by the attorney's office before the FBI gotta start investigating charges, skipping steps in the process, even barring the testimony of Andrew Alvarez, a witness who could tell why any staffing company that could do a dumb rat street credit check would stick out their neck if there was no prospect they could collect. When they're reeling the net, it all relates to Harvey Silver's late statements about the vagueness of federal law, judicial chaos, A_just cause. Read at rp6.org, 347-205-9620, just blog. It's just us, but we don't gotta just talk. We can just march to the courts for the cause with one voice. It's just free them all.
Come on.
I'm Sam Thurman with Cliff Stewart and Ethel Lopez of A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
Join us here each week as we bring you compelling stories about the U.S. judicial system. We explore cases of wrongful convictions and our efforts to right the wrongs, like the IRP 6 case.
And you don't want to miss our featured segment called Exoneree Moment, where exonerees share their stories. That's A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
Sam Thurman,
Cliff Stewart,
and Ethel Lopez.
Education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Check AJCRadio.com for program schedules.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman with Ethel Lopez. Cliff Stewart will be joining us here shortly. Also, just want to welcome everyone to the program this evening. Our phone number is 347-205-9620, 347-205-9620. Our subject this evening is on juvenile injustice. And also, if you're familiar with the program, you know that we have a segment that we call the Conservative Champions Commentary. And so for this evening, we reached out to RightOnCrime.com. And RightOnCrime.com is actually part of the Texas Public Policy Foundation. And so this evening, we have a representative from Right on Crime, and his name is Mr. Reddy. He is a policy analyst. Are we ready to bring Mr. Reddy in on the line? Mr. Reddy, are you there?
Yes, I'm right here. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing fine. I'm happy to be on with you tonight.
Hey, want to really say how much we appreciate you joining the program. I know we started coordinating this yesterday with Sarah, and Sarah worked it out, and you kind of moved some things around, and you're going to spend just a little bit with us talking about the Texas Public Policy Foundation and Right on Crime. And we, you know, as I told Sarah yesterday, as part of our Conservative Champions commentary, we actually rely quite a bit on you guys' website because of the
oh, terrific.
And the what you guys are doing as far as judicial reform.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about the organization. And I see here also that you have contributed to some works as far as juvenile prosecution, as far as juvenile systems. And so you can share a little bit about that with us. But tell us a little bit about your organization.
Sure. Well, we're a think tank, Texas Public Policy Foundation, based in Austin, Texas. We're a think tank like any other think tank your listeners may be familiar with, the Cato Institute, the Brookings Institute, et cetera. But we focus on state-based issues primarily, and state-based issues in the state of Texas, where we're located. We're a think tank that focuses on free markets and individual liberty and limited government. Those are our guiding principles. So, you know, we lean to the right of center. And I think that a lot of our positions in a lot of different areas would not surprise most of your listeners because we are right-leaning. I don't know how many friends it will make me, but, you know, we are skeptical of Obamacare, for example, in our healthcare research. We are proponents of increased school choice in education. We're a right-leaning organization. Now, where I think we're interesting is that I feel we are consistent across the board on our position in favor of limited government. And we apply that same principle to criminal justice policy. And we say, listen, if conservatives are going to be very skeptical of every single dollar that government spends when it comes to schools and when it comes to healthcare and when it comes to all these different areas, why aren't we equally skeptical of the dollars the government is spending on prisons?
Right.
Prisons are a huge government program. That's what they are at the end of the day. Criminal justice is a government program. Now, it's a necessary government program, and we obviously want courts, and we need prisons, and we need these institutions, but we need to be very careful, and as citizens, we need to be very skeptical of what the government is doing, how it is doing it, making sure that we have efficiencies, making sure that liberties aren't being trampled upon. And so we have focused for many years on this kind of political agenda or policy agenda, rather, in the state of Texas. We've been very successful, I'm proud to say, and we can talk a little bit about the successes here in Texas. But we've been so successful that we really found ourselves in a position to expand all of this work nationwide. And that's what launched Right on Crime. And Right on Crime is really an effort to kind of tell other states, look at what Texas has done, look at how, you know, the kind of ultimate hang-'em-high, tough-on-crime state Texas has done in the field of criminal justice. We've managed to gain in terms of public safety, but we've spent less money, and I think at the end of the day we've done a better job of limiting government and preserving civil liberties.
And, you know, one of the things that I like to go and do research, and I look at, you know, the priority issues for Right on Crime, and you have overcriminalization, juvenile justice, substance abuse, adult probation, parole and reentry, law enforcement, prisons, and victims. And as I stated, you know, we pulled information from here that has, you know, it aligns with a lot of the conversations that we have with regard to, you know, when you talk about overcriminalization, then that leads to the overcrowding of prisons. And then that leads to, you know, folks like the director of the BOP, at least mm-hmm. at the federal level,
right.
You know, sitting before Congress and saying, hey, my guards are now in danger because the ratio of guard to inmate is getting out of whack.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when I some of the things that you guys have online here,
mm-hmm.
it's, you know, it's encouraging from the standpoint of, you know, we have folks who are actively involved
exactly.
in reforming the system.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, thank you. You know, I really feel like this is the areas where you can get some bipartisan agreement in the United States these days are becoming few and far between, but I really feel like this is a terrific area where we can get these kinds of points of consensus. And interestingly, it's not necessarily happening because two different sides are meeting in the middle. I think two different sides of the political aisle have totally different agendas, and they're traveling different paths, and yet somehow the paths intersected. And that's
yeah.
terrific. That means that we can get real policy change. I'm optimistic.
And that's good. But, you know, I was reading, you know, here in under the Policy Center on the website, it says legislators responded to a state projection that they would need to spend $2 billion on 17,000 new prison beds and instead put a smaller, about $243 million, into alternatives for nonviolent offenders such as probation, drug court, and mental health treatment. And that is awesome.
Yes, that's the story I was alluding to earlier when I talked about Texas's successes. It really is something I'm quite proud of. In 2007, we had a state agency. It's called the Legislative Budget Board. They came to Texas senators and representatives, and they said, we have a growing state. A lot more people are coming in, and more people just means that we're going to need more prison beds. I mean, we have more good people coming in. We have more bad people coming in. We just have more of everyone. And they said, we'll need about 17,000 new prison beds by the year 2012, and it's going to cost $2 billion. Let's spend the money. Well, we actually had a budget surplus at the time, so we were flush with cash. And yet the Texas senators and representatives said, just because you have the cash doesn't mean you need to spend all of it. This is kind of a silly way to do governance. Mm-hmm. And so they went back and said, what can we do to spend a far smaller amount of money and get better results on the preventative end so that you won't actually need to incarcerate all these people later on down the line? Right. And what they determined was that if you made probation and parole tougher, if you made, you know, monitoring a lot more serious, if you instituted drug courts that, you know, forced people who have drug problems to reckon with those problems rather than actually just throwing them into cells where they get no treatment for this chemical addiction. If you did these kinds of things on the front end, then later on down the line, you wouldn't need all those prison beds. And as a matter of fact, 2012 did roll around. Not only did we not need the 17,000 prison beds, we shut down a prison. It was the first time in 2011 that the state of Texas in modern history had actually closed down a prison facility. And I'll do you one better. 2 years later, in 2013, we closed down another two. So it's been a total of three prison closures.
Oh, wow.
Well, you know what? You guys should have had Director Samuels in on that meeting and show him how things work, you know, as a whole.
Yeah, yeah. So since our subject this evening, our overall subject is on juvenile injustice, talk to us a little bit about your contributions. And I know you guys just had a forum or a session in December on making the case for smart juvenile prosecution. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, the juvenile area is a little bit different than the adult area because kids need a little bit more programming. They have to go to school. We still have to continue to educate them. And, you know, their brains are obviously not developed in the way that adult brains are. And so it costs a little more to treat and rehabilitate and, you know, keep behind bars when that is needed, juveniles. Now, just because it costs more doesn't mean that, again, you need to just be reckless and start cutting blank checks. I mean, you have to be really careful, and you have to look at what actually is going to be effective at improving public safety. You know, whenever you're talking about a young person, if you walk them up and put them in a very difficult carceral situation where they're not going to get past whatever juvenile problems they're dealing with, they're probably going to be back there someday over and over and over again. And when you are locking up a kid who is 14 as opposed to a man who is 40, you are paying for decades of this person being locked up, decades, you know. And this is a person who is not out there being a productive taxpayer. You know, I actually heard a great turn of phrase once by former Republican Congressman J.C. Watts. He said, and he's a great conservative, he said, I don't think we should have more taxes. I think we should have more taxpayers. What he meant to say, what he was intending to say there is that, you know, he wants more people who are out actually working rather than behind bars living off the public dime. And I think that makes a lot of sense, particularly in the juvenile context.
Awesome. Don't go anywhere. I know you have just a few more minutes that you're going to be spending with us. We have to take this quick break. We're going to come back on the other side, get some closing comments from you, and tell folks how they can get in contact with you. Our phone number this evening, listeners, is 347-205-9620, 347-205-9620. On the phones with us is Vic Rontredi from the Texas Public Policy Foundation. He is the policy analyst for the Center for Effective Justice. This is a Just Off Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. We'll be right back.
I'm a mother.
I'm a father.
I'm a sister.
A registered nurse.
I serve my country in the United States military.
I'm your neighbor.
I sit next to you at church.
And my child was
arrested,
held in custody,
questioned without my knowledge,
exposed to violence,
witnessed to rape,
placed in solitary confinement,
unable to call or see me,
shackled to a wall,
beaten,
sentenced as an adult at age 17,
sentenced as an adult at age 16,
sentenced as an adult at age 15.
We felt lost,
isolated,
ostracized,
misjudged,
terrified,
and in the absence of all hope, my child took his own life.
And then I found the Alliance for Youth Justice.
They gave me the support and resources to get through one of the most difficult times in my life.
Now I know I'm not alone.
And neither are you.
Now we have a voice.
Now we have power.
In numbers.
In numbers.
In numbers.
We can make a difference.
There are approximately 2 million children in the juvenile and criminal justice system in this country. These are the faces of those families. If you are the family member of a child who has been in the justice system, or if you are someone who supports this movement and is ready to make a difference, visit the Campaign for Youth Justice at www.campaignforyouthjustice.org.
We know you care. Now it's time. Time to change the face of justice.
Did you know that minority and youth participation in juries is extremely low to non-existent?
The incidence of youth and minority offenders faced with trials has exploded.
Youth and minorities are not being represented as they should be.
We must represent for people to get fair trials.
If you acquire a state ID or driver's license, it allows you to register to vote.
And it allows you to become eligible for jury service.
If you're 18, a U.S. citizen with a state ID or driver's license, and registered to vote,
you're eligible to be called for jury duty.
If called and selected, make it your duty to serve.
We can't get justice without you.
Change.
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 Change the face of justice.
Check your local county or state jury service website for further details.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman with Ethel Lopez. On the phones, we have Vikrant Reddy. He is the policy analyst for the Texas Public Policy Foundation. And just sharing a little bit of information about the organization and Right on Crime and some of the initiatives that's going on there. And we're highlighting that organization as part of our Conservative Champions commentary. And Ethel, you had a quick question.
Yes, Mr. Reddy, I was looking here at something. I guess it's an initiative. I don't know if this has been enacted yet, but it's talking about split sentencing. Can you expound on that a little bit for me?
Yeah, you know, basically what we're getting at when we talk about split sentencing, you know, to speak in very broad terms, is really the importance of parole in corrections. There is this kind of sense, and it was really popular during the 80s, that truth in sentencing is what it was all about, because, you know, people would get some kind of a sentence, but they didn't actually serve that amount of time because, you know, they got out on parole early, and in this sense, they were kind of getting away with something. Well, you know, that's not really what parole is there for. Parole is there because sometimes you have to go to prison. We all accept that. But when you come out, it's very, very difficult. And if you're not provided some kind of, you know, level of resources by the state, by society, then most likely you're going to reoffend and just end up in prison all over again. And so that really is what parole is intended for. Now, it has to be strong parole. It has to be parole where people are required to, you know, demonstrate that they're getting back on their feet, they're finding a job, that they're providing for their families, that they're doing all these kinds of things that are so important to living a fully functioning life.
Right.
And there are too many cases where that sort of thing is not happening. In fact, I'm really sad to say this, but I've heard of cases even right here in Texas where people are just flat released from administrative segregation, we call it, which is solitary confinement, more or less. And, you know, what solitary confinement does to a person's mental state is relentless. And to be released from that state right out to the streets and then told, okay, go get a job, get a cell phone, go get a car, do all these kinds of things, it is extremely difficult. So people really need split sentencing. They need a period where they are incarcerated, but they also need that period where they're on parole.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. That makes sense. That makes sense. So is that something that has been enacted, or is that what you're still looking at?
Well, we have a few areas in Texas with, you know, different kinds of jails and prisons and all sorts of unique facilities. There are some facilities, we call them the Texas State Jails, where, you know, you really don't have this kind of split sentencing, and we think it's incredibly important to implement it. I would also say, by the way, at the federal level, they largely don't have parole, and it makes a lot of sense to look at bringing that back.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So how can folks get in contact with you and get more information about the Texas Public Policy Foundation, and as well as Right on Crime and get on your mailing list so that they know when certain events are coming up and so forth?
Yeah, the easiest thing to do is to go to rightoncrime.com. That's our website. They can take a look at our statement of principles. It's been signed by Grover Norquist and Newt Gingrich and Jeb Bush. I mean, very conservative guys here, but people who understand, again, that you've got to be consistent whenever it comes to limiting government. And they can get on our email list. They can find our Twitter feed. They can find our Facebook page. All those things you can get to just by going to rightoncrime.com.
Awesome.
Great.
Okay, that's Vic Runt Reddy with the Texas Public Policy Foundation. He is a policy analyst, coordinates Right on Crime campaign, and we appreciate you taking time out of your evening to join us and share with our listeners some of the initiatives that are going on with regard to judicial reform. And so we appreciate it, and I understand that you're willing to come back at some time and talk in a little bit more length about some of those initiatives and about the organization. So, again, appreciate you joining the show this evening.
Thank you. I'd love to be back. I had a great time talking with you two tonight. Bye.
All right.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good night. Okay, this is the Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our number this evening is 347-205-9620. Again, 347-205-9620. So, Ethel, getting back to our theme as far as juvenile injustice, and I was looking at this one article, and you can find a lot of information on Equal Justice Initiative on their website.
That's true.
And EJI.org, and talking about children in prison. And it's this one article is talking about children in adult prisons, and it says across the United States, thousands of children have been sentenced as adults and sent to adult prison. And it says here that, you know, nearly 3,000 nationwide have been sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. So that goes back to what you were talking about earlier with regard to, you know, the Supreme Court striking down the laws allowing them to sentence kids to prison without parole. Now, that takes us to another article here where, you know, there's consideration that has to be given for those old cases.
That's true.
You know, and so, you know, I'm going to ask you, Ethel, you know, what do you think? You know, looking at this article, I think you got a copy of it over there.
Yeah.
You know, when a person was incarcerated as a youth prior to the Supreme Court ruling, you know, should their case be reconsidered? I mean, should they not, you know, be finishing out their time of life in prison without a possibility of parole?
I think they should be given that consideration. You know, I mean, in prison, since they were, 13, 14, 15, 16 years old, they've already spent their entire life there. And you're 30-something, 40-something years old now coming out. You know, what you're looking at right now, why not?
And, you know, I saw a story on the Internet yesterday. And there is a gentleman who was just released in El Paso, Texas. And it says that literally he has spent half of his life in prison. Now, he's 32 years old.
There you go.
I mean, can you imagine being 32 years old?
There you go.
He was sent to prison when he was 16, and basically it was one of those coerced confessions like we've heard so many times with those kids, and it had to deal with a drive-by shooting. And you know, they're saying that this guy was in a particular vehicle, and he was part of this drive-by shooting and had several people to say that he was not part of it.
That's ridiculous.
And it took 16 years?
And, you know, another thing, too, that gets me with this, you've got grown-ups that go in prison right today for committing murder, and they get less time than these kids are getting, their entire lives taken away from them. That is just over the top. You know, and whatever they do to stop that, every state needs to start enacting some kind of law or putting something in place, you know, to call that. Because I think that's terribly wrong.
Yeah, and you know, you think about this guy's name is Daniel Villegas.
Mm-hmm.
And actually it says here, and I misquoted, he's actually 37 years old.
Wow.
And so, you know, he spent quite a bit of time. And you know, one of the a good twist to the story, I guess, is that they said his first stop when he got out, he went to church.
All right, then.
You know, he went to church.
That's a good thing.
And then he is relaxing with his family. But, you know, it says, you know, that false confessions provided by youth have become a more pervasive issue regarding wrongful convictions in the United States. And it says in a recent study of 328 wrongful convictions in the U.S., it was found that 44% of juveniles provided a false confession in comparison to only 13% of adults. Now, you know, I don't necessarily agree with this term false confession.
Mm, exactly.
I mean, what is a false confession?
No, that's a beat-out confession.
Yeah, I mean, that's a nice way of saying, you know, somebody threatened me.
Exactly.
And, I mean, because we've heard, you know, we've heard of many stories coming out of New York.
Yeah.
The Central Park Five.
That's what I was just about
you know,
to say, yeah.
When we
yeah.
had Youssef on from the Central Park Central Park Five.
Exactly.
And, you know, and he shared the stories and of how they were coerced.
That's
and,
right.
And then, you know, you have other stories out of New York. You hear the story of Jeffrey Deskovic.
Exactly.
Who was on the program on Tuesday.
Yeah.
And talking about, you know, how he was a young teen. And his confession was a coerced confession.
That's right. And, so, Cervantes? What is his name? The Clemente.
Yes.
His was also, and it was about 30 of them out of Illinois that this, happened to. Same exact thing.
And so, you know, this kind of thing is the kind of thing that we need to ensure that we have reforms in place. Some of the, just like what Vikrant was just talking about, you need to have folks who look at the fact that there's a lot of money being spent on prisons, on incarceration. What on Tuesday we were talking about how 30% of the of DOJ's budget is for prison type stuff. And over $6 billion?
Yes.
And so we have to do something to ensure that gets turned around. So on the other side of this next break that's coming up, we're going to have Mark Reiner. And Mark is a legal analyst, and he's also the attorney for Curtis Shuler in Texas. And so Mark, I believe, is going to be able to shed a lot of light on the situation as far as juvenile injustice. You know, Mark can give it to us from both sides of the aisle.
That's right.
Because he is a defense attorney. He was also a prosecutor.
Yeah.
And so when he was on the other night, you know, he shed some really good insight as to, you know, what goes on the prosecutor side.
Right.
And
right.
I think that kind of, you know, you kind of listen to how that gives him drive to do his absolute best to defend some of these kids out there. So this is the Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our phone number this evening, 347-205-9620. 347-205-9620. We'll be right back after this.
Hey, I'm Rihanna. We all love getting the day off from school on Martin Luther King Day, but have you ever thought about what Dr. King would have wanted us to do? Celebrate Dr. King's legacy with me. Take the Kindness and Justice Challenge. Be kind to someone you would normally ignore. Stand up for what you believe. Commit acts of kindness and justice. Remember, this isn't just another day. It's our chance to recreate history. Now is the time to live the dream. Get off the couch and do something. Check out dosomething.org to find out how.
Police Department.
Hey, we've had some break-ins in my neighborhood, and there's a real suspicious guy. He looks black.
Did you see what he was wearing?
A dark hoodie, like a gray hoodie.
I think the hoodie is as much responsible for Trayvon Martin's death as George Zimmerman was.
Do I look suspicious?
Do I look suspicious?
Am I suspicious?
This guy looks like he's up to no good, or he's on drugs or something. It's raining and he's just walking around looking about.
Are you following him?
Yeah.
Okay, we don't need you to do that.
You have to recognize that this whole stylizing yourself as a gangster, you're going to be a gangster wannabe, well, people are going to perceive you as a menace.
I am here to continue the research to fight cancer.
Detective, sir.
To prosper in real estate.
I am here to be a pediatrician.
I'm here to protect my children and my grandchild.
To fight for justice.
To write the next great American movie.
To give a voice to the voiceless.
I'm here to foster a generation of young black entrepreneurs.
I am here to live.
I am Trayvon Martin.
I am Trayvon Martin.
I am Trayvon Martin.
I am Trayvon Martin.
We are Trayvon Martin.
It's time to wake up. What happened to you?
Dust Talk Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about digital injustice and family services, along with Ethel Lopez. So, Ethel, this evening we're talking about juvenile injustice.
Yeah.
And we talked to Vic Rontredi from RightOnCrime.com, and we're going to be talking to Mark Reiner here shortly. Mark's running just a little bit behind, but hope to bring him in soon.
Yeah.
But, Ethel, during the break, we were talking about how, you know, the incarceration of parents.
Yeah.
You know, let's talk about the other side of the impact of on juveniles when it comes to incarceration. You know, you have folks, you have their parents who end up getting incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
And even Vikram was talking about that just a moment ago.
Right.
As far as, you know, the impact of kids being incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were reading something also earlier about how the impact of the environment that a kid is from. And
exactly.
So, you know, when you have like nearly 80% of them witness violence in their homes, and then, you know, they witness weekly violence in their neighborhoods and so forth, and how that impacts them. Well, there's another side to this equation. The kids who are impacted by the standpoint that their parents are locked away.
And something else to that, you know, these kids that are juvenile offenders, these kids that are being locked away, look at it. Are any of their parents or have any of their parents been imprisoned, you know, wrongly or what have you? You know, a lot of that stuff, you know, that's what you have to look at as well, that their parents have been to prison. And just looking at with the IRP 6 case, you know, with these guys, and thank God that, you know, these guys have grown up and been taught the way that they have been taught, and they are sitting there wrongly convicted and should never be there. But when you look at their kids, if these families have not come from the environment that they came from, these kids would grow up angry with the system.
Absolutely.
You know, they would lash out, you know, and end up being some of the ones that are sitting right there in prison.
And
you
know,
know?
I always go back to the day of sentencing of all the guys.
Mm-hmm.
And the way Judge Christine Arguello handled that situation, and even, you know, you think about Clinton Stewart and his daughter. At the
exactly.
time, she was underage.
That's right.
And you know, a single father
yeah.
raising his daughter.
Yeah.
And then, you know, all of a sudden, you see your dad being carted, you know, escorted off
exactly.
in chains. And the judge absolutely took no consideration
None.
At all for the fact that, and as you stated, Ethel, you know, except for the fact that there is a that there was a nice, neat support system
exactly.
there. You know, Tiffany would have ended up out on the street or
exactly.
in a shelter. Or anything could have happened to this young girl.
Anything.
And so, you know, when these kind of things are happening, it's, you know, I look at some of the policies and some of the laws that are being considered right now, and
mm-hmm.
I think Patrick Leahy is working on,
right.
on one
mm-hmm.
Where they're talking about the safety valve.
Yeah.
You know, where it gives judges a little bit of latitude, so it's like, no, this thing about mandatory minimums
right.
and all this kind of stuff,
right.
it's like, no, they need to have a little bit of latitude
That's
in
right.
what they're doing.
That's
provided
right.
that, you know, it is a judge with a little bit of conscience.
Thank you.
And actually has a heart.
And there are some out there, you know,
yeah.
like we said.
Yeah,
you
there
know,
are
there,
some.
There
yeah,
are some
not,
out there. But,
our favorite woo. Phrase, we're not going to throw the baby out with
there
the
There you go, exactly.
Okay, we got Mark on the phone. So let's bring Mr. Reiner in. Mark, how you doing this evening, sir?
Good, thanks. How you guys doing?
Awesome,
Great,
awesome.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining the call again. And you know, we're going to talk a little bit this evening about juvenile injustice. And I know that's an area that you have quite a bit of experience in. And so wanted you to shed some light on that for us with our audience. And, you know, let's start off. We can just as an introductory, you know, when we talked to you a couple of weeks ago, we were introduced to you as we looked into the story of Curtis Schuller and his case. And you were brought onto that case because of another juvenile case that you were dealing with in Florida. So let's kind of talk about how Mark Reiner kind of got involved with juvenile justice.
All right. Well, you know, the very first time I ever got involved was back over at the state attorney's office down in Key West in Monroe County. I started out there in the juvenile division, prosecuting juvenile cases. And it's, you know, I mean, at that level, when you're keeping them in the juvenile system, it's very, very lenient. Unfortunately, you know, Florida has a reputation for direct filing a lot of cases that is charging a lot of juveniles as adults. And that's putting them in the adult system. And I really didn't do much of that. As far as the juvenile system itself, you know, I thought it was pretty fair. It gave a lot of second, third, fourth chances and beyond. Unfortunately, on the defense side, when I got involved, these were cases of children who were direct filed. That is the first case has involving a kid from Jacksonville who was charged with first-degree murder down in Daytona Beach. He was 14 years old at the time. He was convicted when he was 15. And, you know, this was a case, unfortunately, involving a lot of evidence that really would have helped him, a lot of corroborated evidence that was just not allowed to be introduced at the trial level. You know, that said, fortunately, well, it hasn't worked out too well, but fortunately the Supreme Court passed Miller versus Alabama a couple years ago, almost effectively banning mandatory life sentences for juveniles convicted of first-degree murder.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is it doesn't apply, at least so far, retroactively. A lot of states are just, I mean, it's acknowledged by the Supreme Court that it's wrong. Unfortunately, it's not being implemented looking backwards. You have a lot of kids, anywhere from, you know, 18, 19, all the way 20s and 30s, who just, they don't have a chance, at least under Miller, to go back in time and or even right now to even get a parole hearing. There's a case I'm following in the Florida. I'm sorry?
No, go ahead.
Oh, sorry about that. There's a case actually just argued in the Florida Supreme Court a couple days ago, Horsley versus State. And they're thinking about at least a 50CA rule, and hopefully the Florida Supreme Court will keep it, that they're reverting for juveniles, even ones that were convicted back before Miller versus Alabama, to get their sentences changed from life without the possibility of parole to 25 life, meaning that once they hit 25 years of DOC time, which is probably about 17, 16 years of good behavior, they can be eligible for parole. it's better than nothing.
And, you know, Mark, we were just actually before you came on, we were talking about that and looking at the Supreme Court ruling on the ban on mandatory life without parole for juvenile sentencing and talking about, you know, should it apply to juveniles who were convicted prior to Alabama, Miller versus Alabama.
Right.
And so, you know, when you're talking about that, and Ethel and I were just talking from the standpoint that, you know, far too many kids, and in a lot of cases, and I think you're familiar with some of this, you have coerced confessions, and then you have these kids that sitting in prison for 15 and 20 years. Obviously, you know, by the time they come out, they're no longer a kid.
Exactly.
But you get in a situation where someone was sentenced to life without parole, and I don't know, you know, obviously I'm not an attorney, but, you know, I don't know all the situations where a person could find themselves in that type of situation, but I would hate to see a kid that got that kind of sentence and is sitting there wrongfully convicted, and it happened before Miller versus Alabama.
Yeah.
And they have absolutely no chance.
I agree. I mean, it's horrible. And obviously, what's different from a kid, you know, 5 years ago from a kid being convicted today? I mean, nothing. I mean, they're the same immaturity that the Supreme Court found would exist in their mind, that would exist in their, you know, their situation and their family with regard to their neighbors and their schooling is the same thing that existed 5 years ago. I mean, the only thing at all is just the sense that it would maybe somehow overburden the court system to go back and spend, you know, 20 minutes to an hour on having a hearing on these kids.
And a question for you, Mark, do you find that kids who have been sentenced to these life sentences, what is their mental state as opposed to others who are doing maybe 10, 15 years? Or have you had the opportunity to be in contact with them or anything of that nature?
I mean, I've definitely, you know, spent time with people with a difference of people who were sentenced as juveniles to life without parole, to people sentenced with, you know, 5 year sentence, 10 year sentence, a 15 year sentence, and I mean, obviously the psychological outlook is a lot different. Really, the only thing if you have a life without parole sentence is the idea in your mind that, you know, hopefully your attorney or hopefully the Supreme Court, there will be a confluence of events that will allow you to either be pardoned or paroled or have your appeal overturned. And I think, you know, I haven't met anyone without that hope, but I think that's the only thing that could even it out to someone who knows for sure that they're going to get out on a certain date.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that makes sense. At least, you know, having some hope, because if they have no hope, they have nothing. Nothing. So that is a good thing and something to look forward to, because this is stuff is just ridiculous, you know. And it seems like it's in every state. Wherever you go, they like take no consideration for these children. And like Sam and I were saying, you know, their environment, where they came from, and you know how they've grown up, the household, all of that stuff. They don't take any consideration for these children at 14 years old. How could you give a 14-year-old a life sentence? His life ain't even started yet.
That's right. And you know, Mark, I'm looking at the stats on the Sentencing Project, and they are showing that, at least in the state of Florida, there are like 3,700 juveniles in custody. And then, you know, we look at different statistics as far as at the federal level. You look at the numbers, and I talked a little bit about this at the top of the program, where you have at the federal level those who are under 18. There are 13 people currently incarcerated under the age of 18. Ages 18 to 21, there are 2,700 folks incarcerated. I mean, that's a lot of kids, and so I want to get a little bit more into that as far as. I know you could probably speak to the state of Florida better than anything, but, you know, just from this thing about juveniles and the incarceration, the thing of life without parole for juveniles and all that. Let's talk a little bit about that when we come back from the break. This is Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our phone number this evening is 347-205-9620. 347-205-9620. On the phones, we have Mark Reiner, legal analyst, and at least tonight you are, Mark, and attorney for Curtis Schuller, who was wrongly convicted in Florida. We'll be right back after this.
RISE offers on-site and off-site programming that strengthens young people's ability to successfully navigate the juvenile justice system and empowers them to be advocates for change. RISE's Youth Justice Department provides Know Your Rights education and training, implements restorative justice practices, and offers diversion-based services that allow young people to be active participants and agents in their own liberation.
Not only does texting while driving significantly reduce your reaction time, but you are also 10% more likely to leave your lane. This commercial was 30 seconds. That's all it takes to avoid a senseless tragedy.
We'll be right back.
Dust Calls Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman with Ethel Lopez. Cliff Stewart will be joining us here shortly. On the phones, we have Mark Reiner. This evening, we are talking about juvenile injustice. And, you know, Mark is based down there in Florida, Ethel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were actually looking at a Huffington Post article here a little bit ago, Mark, where it was talking about, you know, how some of the prisons are managed down there. And you got, you know, $100 million in contracts. And,
yep.
And the kids are, you know, there's some lawsuits that are going on down there as well. And, you know, before that break, I was talking about how it looks like in Florida there are over 3,000, almost 4,000 kids that are incarcerated. Now, do you have any statistics on, you know, age groups or anything like that?
You know, I mean, off the top of my head, I can't think of too many, but, the general patterns are in Florida there's certain crimes that are listed out, and burglary, carjacking, robbery, all the way up through to murder, but, you know, even down to burglary. And a lot of these, if you're 17 or 16, they're almost guaranteed, and they're guaranteed direct files. As a prosecutor, they can just unilaterally decide to charge you as an adult. So let's say you're a 16-year-old kid, you get charged with a second-degree felony, whereas a juvenile, you're probably going to get some type of, you know, you may get about 15 days in a juvenile center, and then some type of a really intensive six-month probation where at least you're going to school and whatnot. If you charge an adult and you're given a four-year sentence, I mean, let's say you do get out early in 3 years. You're going to be 19 years old now. The highest education you got was somewhere in the middle of 10th grade when you were arrested. You really don't have, you know, you're for all intents and purposes, and assuming you don't even violate your parole, I mean, you're set up to the people you grew up with, the people you interacted with when you were incarcerated, unfortunately, without having skills, without having an education, you're going to fall back. Let's say you just commit something, you know, low level, even driving on a suspended license, you know, possession of marijuana. Because of your priors, you're going to get multiple prison years again, and it's just going to it's a pattern.
My goodness. Wow.
Now, you know, Mark, let's jump back to this thing about Miller versus Alabama and how the Supreme Court ruled on that. And you know, there's a case that you're intimately familiar with, and that being Curtis Shuler, where Curtis is serving life sentence without the possibility of parole for burglary and killing Larry Steven Tyler in 1998. But there are some extenuating circumstances in that case, even where, you know, you got a situation where it's as if the prosecutor, the DA's office, just wanted to go after Curtis with everything that he has in his arsenal. But when you look at a ruling, a Supreme Court ruling like Miller versus Alabama, you know, you as an attorney for Curtis, how do you see that playing into this case? And I know the last time we talked, you were working on some motions and so forth. But this particular ruling, how do you see that as far as helping Curtis's situation?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, as far as Miller versus Alabama itself, so far the courts in Florida have ruled that it's not to be retroactively applied. So someone like Curtis, who was convicted, you know, his fourth trial in 2004, the courts are basically saying it's, you know, 6 years too late for him. Now they're doing hopefully they're doing it. The 50CA, which is up near the Orlando area in Florida, they ruled that, you know, maybe we can't apply Miller versus Alabama, but under that ruling, they're basically saying you cannot get life without the possibility of parole. And because first-degree murder in Florida, there's only two options. It's a death penalty or life without parole. So you can't get the death penalty as a juvenile anymore. So they're saying because the only other option is life without parole, as a matter of law under Miller versus Alabama, that's not fair. So what that court is saying, and what hopefully the Supreme Court, Florida Supreme Court upholds, is that they're going to go back to the 93 statute, which will allow anyone at Department of Correction 25 years to be eligible for parole. You know, it's not a guarantee, and it doesn't take into those Miller factors at all, like, you know, the maturity of the person, their age, whether they've had prior crimes, their family life, their schooling, their education level. I mean, all these factors laid out in that 76-page opinion, at least, you know, there's some hope. And unfortunately, juveniles who are convicted of first-degree murder are spending more time than adults. I mean, the average juvenile conviction of first-degree murder is about 16 and a half years of age. The average adult convicted of murder is convicted around the age of 30. So that means, you know, assuming, and they have shown that life expectancy is about the same, whether you're convicted as a juvenile or as an adult, that means on average juveniles are getting 18 years more in prison than their adult counterparts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Mark, I was looking at this story. I was talking about it earlier before you came on, Daniel Villegas down in El Paso, Texas. And he spent nearly 20 years in prison. He was 16 years old. So to your point, he was 16 years old. He was wrongfully convicted of murder. And just now, yesterday, was released from prison. He's 37 years old now. And so when you look at a situation like that, you know, I was looking at an article, and it talks about how, you know, kids who get incarcerated at that young age, when they are released, they have, I mean, they're like thrown into a world that they do not know.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, other kids have had an opportunity to get their driver's license, and,
yep,
you know, they play, you know, organized sports or, mm-hmm, or they've done something. But then when you have a kid that's yanked out of their neighborhood and wrongly convicted, I mean, you know, if a kid did something, he knows he did it. But,
right,
you know, for a kid who didn't do anything, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and they get incarcerated, and, you know, Mark, that's terrible when you think about a kid spending, you know, in the case of Daniel Villegas in El Paso, Texas, over half of his life has been spent incarcerated. And so educate us a little bit on this, because you were saying that, so Miller versus Alabama went to the Supreme Court. So that's a Supreme Court ruling that as far as the mandatory life sentence without parole would not be applied to youth. So you're saying that even though that's a Supreme Court ruling, and I guess the when it comes down to discussing kids who were incarcerated prior to this ruling, it's up to the state level at that point to make decisions?
It is going to the state level now, and the reason for that is that the Supreme Court was silent on whether it should be retroactive or not. So a bunch of the appellate courts throughout the country have come up with a rule to decide whether a new law change should be retroactively applied. And it doesn't really make much sense to me, but the actual rule is that if it's a procedural change, then it's not retroactive. If it's a substantive change, then it is. Now, in my mind, whether you can be released from prison or whether you have to spend the rest of your life there, to me that seems like a substantive issue. And to me it seems like the procedural issue is having the hearing itself. So I don't really understand it. I mean, I know that the states have been arguing, or that is the state attorneys or the attorney general's offices have been arguing, that it is merely a procedural change and not a substantive change. But as far as the actual logistics, as in making, you know, a concrete example in front of the court, I haven't really heard one yet. I mean, I know how the judges have ruled, and if you look at the language, you know, they certainly use those terms, substantive and procedural, and they quote a lot of cases. But as far as saying how is someone spending their life not a substantive change in the law, I can't really answer that.
Well, you know, when you look at it, it sounds like a lot of where, I don't know, I don't even know how to put it, Ethel. It's like one of those things that you have kids who have been incarcerated for years,
mm-hmm,
and technically, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mark, technically you could have a kid in sitting, or, and I say kid, you know, you could have two guys sitting in a cell next to each other and who were both convicted or incarcerated as youth,
mm-hmm,
and one can walk out and the other one will be left there,
yeah,
without even any consideration by,
yeah,
the courts,
yeah,
to even take a look at their case.
Exactly.
Is that kind of, does that kind of sum it up, Mark?
I mean, that's exactly what's going on. That's exactly how the courts are ruling throughout the country.
Man. Hey, Mark, don't go anywhere. We got our guest that's going to be joining us, and we invite you to chime in on the conversation when we bring her on. It's going to be Mary Ann Lucas. And we're going to be talking about her son, Mike Lucas, and she's going to be sharing some information with us about his case, as well as some things that she's doing. She's the Pennsylvania director of the Freedom March for the Wrongfully Convicted. We'll be right back. This is Just Cause Coast to Coast where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Stay right there.
Good morning, students, and welcome to Career Day. I hope you're excited to hear about all the great things you can do when you grow up.
Hi, everyone. I'm Emily. I'm super excited to introduce my dad because he's my hero. When I was little, my dad was away a lot. But I was okay with that because he was doing this really important work, driving ambulances in Iraq. Now he's at home, which is great for me because I get to see him every day now. And he's still the biggest hero I know because he tells all the ambulances and the fire engines where to go and rescue people when there's an emergency. I'm so proud of him. He's awesome. He's my dad.
If your service-connected disability prevents you from continuing in your civilian career, Voc Rehab offers counseling, training with a living allowance, education, and other services to help prepare you for your next mission.
I stand for equality.
I stand for individuality.
I stand for peace.
I stand for diversity.
I stand for dignity.
I stand for respect.
I stand for fairness.
Red, yellow, black,
white. We're all the same color.
When you turn out the light.
Today, innocent Americans are standing trial for crimes they didn't commit. Today, innocent Americans are writing for help from a prison cell. Today, hundreds of Americans have been exonerated of crimes they didn't commit. Researchers believe that at least 40,000 innocent Americans still sit behind bars. For them, the answers do not come easy. A Just Cause seeks true balance and accountability in the judicial process, ensuring that innocent men and women are not convicted and sentenced to prison for trivial, obscure acts that are otherwise not seen as crimes. For more information on how A Just Cause may help you or how you can get involved to stop overcriminalization of innocent Americans, visit www.a-justcause.com or call 855-529-4252. That's 855-529-4252.
A Just Cause Coast to Coast. I'm Sam Thurman with Ethel Lopez. Now joining us in the studio, Cliff Stewart. Cliff, how you doing?
Hey, doing good. Had a busy day.
I guess
rushed
so.
To get down here to off the other call. Get down here with you guys. Got a chance to listen to about 10, 15 minutes of it.
You're a man on a mission tonight.
Oh. That's it. Got to get it done. So,
how did that go on that other call?
That went really well. We appreciate Ron Chepik and company, having us on. It was an hour show. It went by, it seemed like, in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But we were able to get them, the information, get his audience a lot of information on what we wanted to have them hear about the IRP 6 case,
mm-hmm.
about all these injustices of false convictions, false imprisonment, just withholding. I think this thing with withholding the court transcript goes along the lines of withholding evidence. In general, in any case,
yeah.
Every time we end up talking to anybody about it, it really gets your blood boiling because you realize that the federal government is on a mission to conspire to put people in jail. I mean, the whole system is broken. The machine, there's something stuck in the cogs, and we really, really need to fight to get it out. I got a chance to listen to a little bit of what Mark was saying about all these juvenile convictions and, it all rolls into the issues about the Department of Justice needs to address how people are being convicted, when and how an actual juvenile gets tried as an adult. I mean, there should be extenuating circumstances for a juvenile to get tried as an adult and be held in that situation for life. I mean, there should be some type of psychological interview that happens that says this person had the mindset of an adult when they committed this crime. And also, you know, along the lines of what Eric Holder was saying, you know, when he made his grandiose speech, he needs to deal with this as well. He needs to deal with it across the board on why is there so many people in prison, as he called it, for no good law enforcement reason. And how do you take a child that did something, you know, when they were a teenager, that made a stupid mistake, you know, may have been driving drunk, may have been doing something while they were intoxicated otherwise than drinking. But, you know, everybody has to have the opportunity at a second chance. You know, people mature, they grow up, and they need to be allowed the opportunity to live their life, even if they did make a mistake.
That's right. And I don't know, Cliff, if you heard the discussion that we were having regarding Miller versus Alabama, and how, you know, as far as the Supreme Court ruling that there is no longer mandatory life without a possibility of parole for a juvenile offender. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when it comes to those who once they pass a certain threshold,
right,
it's like they have no chance right now. And exactly. So, you know, Mark was just sharing some information about that. So on the phones, we have Mark Reiner, legal analyst and also an attorney for a case down in Florida. And Mark is joining us as we discuss juvenile injustice tonight. Also joining us on the call on the show this evening right now, let's bring in Mary Ann Lubas. And Mary Ann is going to share a little bit of information with us regarding the case on her son, Mike Lubas. Right. So is Mary Ann there?
Hi, yes, I am. Thank you for having me.
Hi, Mary Ann. Welcome to the program.
Hi. So, I just wanted to clarify that Mike's name is Mike DeLo.
Ah, okay. All right. Thank you for that clarification. Shoot that information over to either Ethel or Olivia.
Yes.
So that we can post it correctly on our website, because if you've gone out and checked out our website, we do post information about the exonerees and those who are wrongly convicted that we talked to on the program.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I know you and Ethel talked earlier this evening about this case.
Well, we kind of emailed a little bit, and that's when I found out that Mary Ann was the director for this march that's coming up about the wrongly convicted. But why don't you tell us a little bit about your son's situation, Mary Ann?
Well, on what's today, the 16th, so it was yesterday, was his fifth year in prison. We're now starting our sixth year. This is a more of a case of a parental alienation. His ex accused him of harming their daughter, and when all of this came about, Mike cooperated fully and also had DNA testing done. The DNA did not match him, and to further prove his innocence, he also had a vasectomy and could not have been the perpetrator of the sperm that they found. So there was two things that should have exonerated him or even let this never go to trial. Mm-hmm. However, he still did go to trial. We had jurors sleeping. His ex and family were outside smoking with the jurors. After a four-day trial, it took 10 minutes for the jury to come back with a guilty verdict. On March 17th of this year, we will finally be able to have our evidentiary hearing asking for a whole new trial. One of the things that we are very hopeful for, that we do believe he will get a new trial, is because in his original trial, he was never asked if he wanted to testify in his defense, which is a constitutional right violation. So we do believe, at the very least, we will get a new trial. But what we're also trying to change in our justice system is that you cannot, absolutely cannot, take anybody to trial when they have exculpatory DNA prior to trial.
Yeah.
Scientific evidence is indisputable.
Exactly, and that should already be on the books. I mean, you have DNA, it doesn't match. How does that get to trial? How does a judge allow that to move forward? How does a prosecutor not take that and say, this is evidence that proves that this is not the person. And I had a question. Have you guys reached out to the Innocent Project? You know, what other advocacy groups are fighting for Mike?
Mike's case has been with the Pennsylvania Innocence Project now for 3 years. Due to their backlog, not having enough volunteers to help, et cetera, his case is in stage 3 of 4. I just reached out to them a couple weeks ago to find out where his case now sits, and unfortunately they can't give me any information, so Mike is writing to them to get the information. But his case was reviewed by the students of the Tampa Bay University School of Law and by the Center on Wrongful Convictions out of Northwestern University. Both of them have determined his innocence. However, neither one have pro bono attorneys in our state. So the Northwestern University is the one that gave the Pennsylvania Innocence Project our son's case.
Oh, wow. And exculpatory evidence, eyewitness testimony, alibi witnesses. What else did he need?
Yes. Exactly. We so went into this completely blind, and that's why I started the Freedom March, because we knew we were coming home. There's no way he's going to prison. He's innocent. Not only is he innocent, we have the proof he's innocent.
So, Mark,
it was a real eye-opener.
Yeah.
So, Mark, from your perspective as an attorney, when you hear something like this and there's evidence to obviously exonerate someone, yet he's been sitting in prison going into his 6th year now, and it's kind of tied up in legalese, I guess. That would be one way of putting it. When you look at something like that, having been on as a prosecutor as well as a defense attorney, what kind of strategy is open to a defendant like this in this situation?
Well, I mean, obviously with contradictory DNA evidence, when you have these deep physical evidences, things that are generally make a case a slam dunk for the prosecutor and you have them on your side, that's the definition of a reasonable doubt for a jury. I mean, I would say almost as a matter of law, the fact that you have DNA on a victim's body or at a crime scene that doesn't match the person they're trying for that crime, I mean, that's the very definition. You know, what jumped out at me with that story was that the jury came back in 10 minutes. And, you know, if you're not going to convict someone, that's fine. You're going to let someone go 10, 15 minutes to the jury room. I mean, that's enough time. But the fact that as jurors, you're not supposed to talk about the case until you begin deliberation, and the fact that you're supposed to find a person guilty, you know, to the exclusion of each and every single reasonable doubt that was raised at that trial, I just don't understand, just as a logistical matter, how you're going to have, you know, either 6 jurors or 12 jurors, depending on the case, how they're going to go around the room and go through each reasonable doubt that was raised and decide that it's not there and go on to convict. I just, you know, when you're going to put someone in prison for a long time, I just think that you owe the respect to the justice system, to the defendant, to weigh the evidence, and you really can't weigh it unless you put in some time and really discuss what was laid out there.
And, you know, when Marianne mentioned the fact, and correct me if I'm wrong, or did I hear this wrong, Marianne, you said that in front of the courtroom or on the side of the courtroom, smoking with the jurors?
Oh, yes. They ate lunch in the same restaurant. They stood outside of the courthouse and smoked. And when we brought that up to the attorney, he told us the last thing we wanted was a mistrial to keep our mouth shut. As soon as the trial ended and he was convicted, we demanded for him to file for an immediate mistrial, which he did, but it was denied without a hearing.
On the phones, we have Marianne Lubas, and we're talking about her son, Mike, and the wrongful conviction there and some of the things that, and we'll have you talk a little bit about the Freedom March for the wrongfully convicted. So we'll be coming back talking about that. Also on the phones, we have Mark Reiner, who is joining us talking about wrongful convictions and juvenile injustice. This is a Just Cause, Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our number this evening is 347-205-9620, 347-205-9620. We'll be right back after this.
It is with great pleasure that I welcome you to today's graduation ceremony. Students, when you hear the reason or reasons for your absences throughout the years, please exit the auditorium without your high school diploma. Once you've exited, remove your cap and gown and proceed into the unknown. Too tired. Family trip. Part-time job. Helping around the house. Sick day. Starting the holidays early. Just because.
Starting in the sixth grade, students who miss 18 days or more of school in a year for any reason will fall behind and risk not graduating high school. How many days of school has your child missed this year? Absences add up. Keep track at boostattendance.org today. Brought to you by the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
When does it stop being partly cloudy and start being partly sunny? Why is the word abbreviation so long? Are English muffins just muffins in England? Why is it called a washing line and not a drying line? Do fish get thirsty? If ghosts can walk through doors, why don't they fall through floors? Do you yawn when you sleep? If prunes are dried plums, how do they make prune juice? Why do doctors leave the room when you change? They're going to see you naked anyway. Do bald chefs wear hairnets? How much deeper would the ocean be if all the sponges were taken out? Do you believe someone who says they're a chronic liar? Why is sandwich bread square and sandwich meat round? Life's full of hard questions. Ask one more. You might just save a life.
Judicial Injustice. Cliff Stewart, Ethel Lopez, I'm Sam Thurman. Also on the phone, we have Mark Reiner. And we also have, as a guest this evening, Marianne Lubas. And she's sharing the story of her son, Mike. And Mike is going into his sixth year of a wrongful conviction and incarceration.
Yeah.
And so just before the break, we were talking about some of the things, and Mark was sharing with us. You know, there's just some obvious things that should have been taken into consideration in Mike's case. Mm-hmm. And Mark, I'm right there with you as far as, you know, you have a jury that's sitting there and they come back in a matter of a few minutes with a guilty verdict after having been spent time,
absolutely,
you know, smoking with the one who has filed the complaint.
Right.
And, you know, I think about, and I don't know, Mark, if I don't think we talked about it on the show that you were on before, but there's the story of Lamont Banks. And when Lamont was on the program, he talked about, you know, walking into the jury room.
Yeah.
And his, get this, Mark, Lamont Banks, his attorney asked a room full of 60 potential jurors, how many of you believe that because Mr. Banks is sitting in the defendant chair that he did something wrong, that he is guilty of something? And every hand went up. Yet they still pull from that jury pool.
Exactly.
Something is wrong with that.
And, you know, that is sick. And in Lamont's case, the judge stepped in and, you know, tried to help the situation out by telling them that, you know, everybody's innocent until proven guilty. He stepped in and did his duty as a judge. He should have went farther and dismissed all of those jurors.
Right.
But in this situation, it seems like the judge would have had some obligation to say, hey, you cannot be out smoking with the accusers. And if the jury, like you say, Mark, a jury is supposed to go in and deliberate to ensure that all the reasonable doubt basically is off the table, that you have a true guilt on this person. The judge, after 10 minutes, should have said, why are you back out here after 10 minutes? You have a verdict. Your verdict is guilty. How did you come to that conclusion that quick? How did you go around the room with 12 people? You're telling me basically all they did was have a question of each person. Do you think this guy is guilty? Yes, I think he's guilty. And went around the room, no question. Obviously, the jury foreman did not do their job. And the judge, neither. So, Mark, my question for you is, does it seem like, or is there some responsibility of the judge to say, you know, this is a serious miscarriage of justice, that something needs to be done about this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's difficult. On the one hand, you ever see a judge interact with a jury, and it's like these are their constituents, you know, right there in front of them, you know, where they can, you know, these people witness how the judge acts, and the judge, and it's true, you know, I mean, the jury has a very sacred role in our justice system. But I think the role of the judge, though, is, you know, if they've come back in 10 minutes, it's almost too late. I think when you're giving jury instructions, you need to really stress here that the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt. And, you know, it doesn't mean every single doubt. It doesn't mean you need to have a photo of the guy committing the crime. But, you know, the standard is, you know, not just, you know, did the guy probably do it? Is it more likely that he did it? You know, is it 90% he did it? It's a much higher standard. It has to be enough to where, you know, I think if this is your own family member or your own parent, would you say they probably did it? And, you know, that question that you were mentioning in the Banks trial, you know, I think that's something a lot of defense attorneys ask during questioning a jury. And that's, and I've done that before. You ask, suppose right now you had to vote on whether my client committed this crime or not. What, you know, not hearing any evidence so far, how would you decide? And you always have hands shoot up. And I think that's just because there's a fundamental misunderstanding, you know, and it underscores that the court needs to stress more and more that the job of the state is to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. The defense lawyer, you don't have to do a thing. If there's no evidence presented against your client, you move for a judgment of acquittal. I mean, you really, you know, so the fact that you're in that room means nothing. And the fact that people reflexively think you're guilty without a word being said is, you know, tied into the fact that a lot of jurors, they see a police officer come in, you know, with their pressed uniform and their shoes shining. And it's almost as if their words take on this super truth that they're not going to lie. And that if their testimony contradicts the guy sitting there at the table, at the defense table, then you better believe the officer is the one telling the truth. And I think, you know, there just has to be more education, and that needs to go on outside of the trial in the news and in the media, and definitely needs to occur right before a jury goes back there to deliberate. Yeah.
So, Marianne, I'm kind of miffed at you saying that Mike's attorney said, well, no, we don't want to say anything about what's going on outside the courtroom. What was his or her, I don't know if it was a male or female, but what was the attorney's rationale for you know, playing with Mike's life?
That's right.
His reasoning was the last thing you want in a trial is a mistrial. So keep your mouth shut. Don't say a word. Don't worry about it. We have proof on our side that he's innocent, and that's what I'm going to hammer to the jury. Unfortunately, two things happened. The trial attorney did not tell us until the Saturday before the Monday trial that he was not a criminal attorney and had never done a jury trial or a trial of this magnitude.
Marianne, what was this? Did you guys basically have a contract with this particular attorney, or was it a court-appointed attorney, or what was the situation there?
Oh, no, it was a paid attorney. It was one of our church members. And being blind and naive, because we'd never even been in a courtroom, was under the impression we needed an attorney to guide us through this, but the attorney just kept hammering to us, it is the Commonwealth's burden of proof, not ours. Now, during this 14 months leading up to trial, we start researching and we start asking the attorney to do many things, check on A, B, get character witnesses, get, you know, testimony from people. We had, I think it was 38 character witness letters testifying on Mike's, you know, character that he would never, ever, ever do this. Mm-hmm. We had our other two sons were there at the time where the testimony on the prosecutor's side was nobody was there at all during this alleged incident. We had five people there. Our attorney thought by asking all five people to testify it would be redundant. So he only asked two people to testify.
And you know what?
And here we are thinking, I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
And here we are thinking, he's the attorney, he knows better. It was like, it would be like us trying to do heart surgery on someone when we're not a heart surgeon. We didn't know. And that's what prompted me to begin on the Freedom March, is to bring awareness to what the public, what jurors need to know prior to going to a trial.
Mark, it sounds like she needed somebody like you on this case.
And Mark, doesn't she have grounds for basically a retrial or dismissal or mistrial for lack of proper representation by her counsel?
At least put him out of the church.
Well, he's still there, and we just pray.
Yeah, I mean, as far as appeals. You know, I mean, they're obviously, it's difficult because, you know, when you hit the trial level, the burden's all on the state. When you deal with an appeal, the burden is on you showing, and it's not, an appeal's not, you know, I don't like the facts, I don't like the way the jury decided, I want a second shot. An appeal is based on reversible error of the judge. You have to, so even if, you know, let's say you get a witness in that strategically, it wasn't a good idea to have that witness testify for you, or maybe you just forgot to ask certain questions of that witness, of the state's witness. You really don't get, unless you can show the judge did something improper in allowing that testimony to exist, you really don't get another shot. Now, there is something that is, you know, applicable, which is Strickland versus Washington, which is a Supreme Court case talking about ineffective assistance of counsel and the standards for that. And it's a pretty high burden, but, you know, I mean, this case here, I mean, you know, if there's a lot of mishaps and there's a lot of, you know, one thing that sticks out to me is the defense lawyer, you know, possibly saying, I don't want to ruin get a mistrial here. I mean, it seems to me that if you're in that situation, you know, the state's going through their case and, you know, you haven't been able to put on the witnesses you want, or the state hasn't decided to, you know, maybe think back on the charge because of the lack of DNA. I don't know. I don't really see anything wrong with getting a mistrial and you know, making the state decide whether they want to go forward and recharge you again.
Exactly.
Especially if you have strong evidence of your innocence.
Exactly.
It's like, hey, let's go for the mistrial. And I mean, I've never been there, but, you know, to just, you know, yeah. I'm obviously Monday night, or Tuesday morning quarterbacking or something. But I would think that, you know, if you see all of this wrong going on, man, it's like bring it up to the judge.
And if they got to tell the lawyer, you know, about getting character witnesses and stuff, you got to tell them how to do his job. Well, something's wrong. Something is wrong.
Wow. Hey,
that's
go
why
ahead.
I speak out.
Hey,
because,
Marianne.
Like I said, we were naive.
Stay right there, Marianne. We got one more break we're going to take. And when we come back, we're going to have you just kind of share with our listeners how to get in contact with you and how to support the Freedom March for the Wrongfully Convicted. So don't go anywhere. This is A Just Cause, Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. We'll be right back.
Shh. These are the voices that prisoners in solitary confinement hear every day. Out of Arizona's total of 2,076 prisoners held in solitary, 30% are taking prescription medication to deal with mental illnesses, and 11% have diagnosed schizophrenia. Experts report that the extreme and prolonged isolation exacerbates pre-existing conditions and appears to even cause mental illness in prisoners who were not previously ill. While prisoners deserve punishment, Arizona can do better. We need to change the solitary confinement rules. Unlike any other states, Arizona prisoners are held in 8x10 cells for at least 23 hours a day, with no windows and virtually no human interaction. Perhaps the best way to fix solitary confinement so it strikes a balance between punishment and humanity is to decrease the size of solitary units. Colorado, Texas, Mississippi, and Illinois have decreased the size of their units, only admitting prisoners who need the rehabilitating experience, and have saved over $6 million without compromising prison safety. A study produced in Colorado reported that after decreasing the number of solitary units, prisoners experienced an improvement in overall mental health of the confined inmate population. How can we do this? We need to reach out to Director of Corrections Charles L. Ryan, asking him to decrease the number of solitary units. Solitary confinement needs to remain a place for punishment and behavior change, but it can also be a place of innovation and rebuilding.
Michael Adams?
Here.
Michael Adams?
Here.
Michael Adams.
Yeah! Michael Adams.
Students who miss 18 days of school in any grade risk falling behind and not graduating. Absences add up. Keep track at boostattendance.org today.
Just Cause, coast to coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Ethel Lopez, Cliff Stewart, I'm Sam Thurman right here on APT Radio. On the phones, we have Mark Reiner, and he's joining us as a legal consultant, a legal analyst, and also he's the attorney down in Florida and dealing with the Curtis Schuller case. And then also on the phones, talking with Marianne Lubas, and the wrongful conviction and incarceration of her son, Mike. And so, Marianne, we just have a couple of minutes. If you can share with us a little bit of information about the Freedom March for the Wrongfully Convicted, what events you have coming up here soon, and how folks can get in contact with you.
Well, what we're doing is this will be our sixth annual Freedom March, and this year it will be held on March 14th at 1 p.m., on the steps of the Washington County, Pennsylvania Courthouse. What the Freedom March is to what we call the three R's, to raise, resolve, and remedy. We need to raise the accuracy rate in judgments of guilt and innocence, resolve credible post-conviction claims of innocence, and remedy the tragic impact of wrongful convictions. By having these marches, it is our hope that the public that walks by, that attends, the news media, the newspaper, publishes our march to help those that were like us, had no idea how this could happen to them. They can be a little bit smarter and wiser, and also for our potential jurors. We need jury education tremendously.
Yeah.
And every one of us can be called to jury duty at any time. Well, we need to know what the justice system is about. Like you said, just because someone is sitting on the defense table, that doesn't make them guilty.
That's right.
And we believe that's what happened in our son's case.
That's right.
So, Marianne, how can folks get in contact with you?
They can contact me through email at mlubis2 freedommarch@yahoo.com. And if they just put in the subject line, Freedom March, then I'll know it's not spam or unwanted email.
Okay. And so, Marianne, we will be posting that type of information on our website as well. And so we just want to be sure we have all the correct information. Again, if you'd like to reach out to Marianne, that's mlubas, M-L-U-B-A-S, 2, the number 2, at yahoo.com. And she is the Pennsylvania director of the Freedom March for the Wrongfully Convicted. Coming up is the 6th annual Freedom March for the Wrongfully Convicted in Pennsylvania. And they're fighting for the exoneration and release of her son, Mike. And so more information about that you can get by contacting Marianne. Marianne, we want to thank you for joining the show,
yeah,
joining the program this evening and sharing your story. And those who can possibly help in any way, you know, go out and support Marianne in that march.
Absolutely.
And we appreciate it.
Thank you, Marianne, very much.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
So, Mark, we're on the downside of this one. Give us some closing thoughts as to, you know, some things that, you know, I'm sure you've thought about this with some of the cases that you've been involved in. And even as we talk about the, you know, Supreme Court ruling in Miller versus Alabama, what are some things, going back to our main theme as far as juvenile injustice, what are some things that you see that need to happen with regard to reform in our juvenile system?
Well, you know, I think even before you look at someone getting arrested, I think a lot of it starts in our school system. And I know at the last show last week, you guys were talking about the Eric Holder gave a speech about the zero tolerance policies that school boards have throughout the country. And, you know, I think a big problem here is that you have these schools with tons of assistant principals, tons of people, you know, counselors and people that are above teachers whose role it is to decide, you know, how to look after these kids who don't have their parents there at school and how to make the school function. And rather than looking at actions, you know, kids fighting or kids pulling someone's hair, something, what kids do, they've reverted to this, we're not going to decide, we're not going to adjudicate anything at all, we're just going to expel these kids. So these kids get expelled, they go to alternative schools where all these other kids are expelled who have been given up by, or some districts that don't have alternative schools, and the kids can't afford private schooling, they effectively drop out. These are the types of kids who interact, and it's more and more, they're interacting more with the police. You know, they're not in school, they're not learning, and then they get involved in the juvenile system early, and you have these prosecutors seeing these same kids over and over again, and they start getting tired of it, and eventually they start treating these kids as adults, younger and younger. So you get these adults going into adult prison, or these children going to adult prison, sometimes they're coming out and they're still children going back and interacting with kids back in their hometown. And it's this cycle that just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And then you have these private prisons coming in. You have uninformed jurors. You have, you know, prosecutors not doing Brady, you know, turning over Brady exculpatory evidence. And it's this perfect storm of factors that you're going to really have to change the entire philosophy in this country of how we look at guilt, how we look at convictions, whether we want to decide to give up on kids who do something bad, or whether we really want to try to get at the root of the problem and you know, treat these kids, you know, as if we respect them individually and not just, you know, write everyone off, lump them together, zero tolerance, first strike and you're out.
Yeah, it's like they give the kids, you know, less of a chance than they give the adults. With adults, you know, they have the three strike rule, which is the one of the dumbest things I've ever heard of, you know. But they give the kids, like you say, one strike, your first offense, you're tried as an adult, and then you're put in prison. And, okay, they have where, well, now it can't be mandatory life sentences for a juvenile tried as an adult. But just like, you know, the story that we read, I believe, last week, where this kid gets 55 years for $300 worth of marijuana. Now, yeah, they didn't give him life, but they give him all these charges lumped on each other and on each other and on each other. Mm-hmm. And then you end up where you have a person, you know, like they give these crazy sentences, 300 years mm-hmm. plus 20 on each. All this crazy stuff. So they don't say we're giving you life in prison. We're just giving you 420 years. Well, how long do they expect a person to live?
Exactly.
It's totally ridiculous, and it needs to, you know, like I said before, needs to come down from the top. Eric Holder made a statement, but he really needs to, you know, get in there and do something. I mean, for the kids' sakes, for the family's sakes, for everybody who's falsely convicted and is spending any time in a prison. You know, one day is too long when you have not committed a crime.
And, you know, I also, just piggybacking off of what Mark was just saying, you know, a guest that we had on earlier from the Center for Effective Justice and the Texas Public Policy Foundation, Vic Rontreddy, and he was talking about, you know, in the work that they're doing as far as making the case for smart juvenile prosecution. And, you know, I think the whole premise there, if you look at their website, it's almost like, you know, you've heard the saying that it takes a village. And so, like you're saying, Mark, instead of throwing the kids out onto the street or throwing them all together into a charter school for troubled kids, it's like, you know, we need to implement some programs, go back to the old way, so to speak, and do some things to some corrective action within the schools, within the communities. I remember growing up, man, if my baseball or football went in somebody's yard, I went to the front door, rang the doorbell, and said, "Hey, Mrs. Davis, I'm sorry my football went in your yard. Can I walk out there and get it?" You know, and so we need to implement some of those kind of things these days. And Mark, we're right there with you. Thanks for joining us. Mark Reiner spent the evening with us talking about legal issues and reform and judicial injustice, things that need to be done in the juvenile injustice arena. So, Mark, we appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
And thanks
so
for
much.
Hanging out with us.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Awesome. So we'll be talking to you again soon, Mark. Have a good weekend. As far as the IRP 6 goes, again, like we talked at the top of the program, you know, we've got a lot of things going on there. We're expecting some really, really good news to be coming up. But we already have good news. It's a lot of things we're just not going to talk about right now. But we want to also give a shout-out, though, to the attorneys that are working on that again. Mark Garagus, Tina Glandian, Gwendolyn Solomon. And, you know, Mark is actually being sworn in as the president-elect of the National Trial Lawyers.
Congratulations,
right,
Mark.
Yeah, so congratulations, Mark. Now get back to work. That man works 24/7. So I'm sure Mark knows what we mean when we say that.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, keep our brothers in prayer. IRP 6, we're talking about Gary Walker, David Banks, Demetrius Harvey, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, and Dave Cipolla. Ethel, what can folks do right now to find out more information about the IRP 6? What can they do right now to help out as far as getting some justice for our brothers?
We're asking you to reach out to your local radio television stations and ask them why are they not covering this case. We also are asking you to call Attorney General Eric Holder's office at 202-514-2003 and 2005 and ask them to investigate case of the missing transcript.
And also, go out to change.org, do a search on IRP 6, sign that petition. We're now approaching 700 signatures on that. And so go out there, sign it. Also, put some information in there as to why you are signing it. Ethel.
Yes, and I want to say, too, for the people to go out and sign a petition on Curtis Schuler. There's a petition out there, acquitted but still serving life without parole since he was 16. Please go out and sign that petition.
And then the Central Park Five, they have a hearing coming up on the 27th of January in, I believe it's the 27th, in New York. And so support them. Cliff.
All right, I want to say thank you to our guest, Attorney Mark Reiner and Marianne Lubis. We're still in there pushing for you guys. Also want to say thank you to everybody in the chat room, K&D Productions, Captain Kyle and Dustin Jackson in the control room, helping out Ill Skillers Girls. Also want to say thank you to the AJC Radio support team. Couldn't do it without you guys. And to the truth, we know you're out there. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. All right, and to Miss Barbara and Olivia, thank you so much.
Hey, and Vic Rontreddy also joining us tonight. This is A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Good night, America.
Good night, y'all.